The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Epic of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish history based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKollel, Dean of the Kollel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America.
This lecture, titled Rav Yitzchak Alfasi and the Rise and Fall of North African Jewry, is dedicated to the memory and le'ilui nishmas Mordechai ben Nisim Olav HaShalom, Mr. Andrei Tweetu of blessed memory, and to the merit and honor of Mrs. Rose Tweetu, Mr. and Mrs. Fred and Betty Niederlander, and Mordechai and Mr. and Mrs. David and Miriam Niederlander.
Jewish history books are full of names of obscure cities across the globe that today hardly contain any Jews. In their heyday, however, many of these now forgotten cities contained Jewish communities that were major centers of learning and culture and produced personalities that had a major impact on world Jewry. Such is the fate of many of the communities of North Africa. There was a time that Africa produced the greatest minds of Jewry. Besides Rav Sadia Gaon in Egypt, North Africa produced the early grammarians Rav Dunash ben Tamim, Rav Yehuda ben Koresh, Rav Dunash ibn Labrat, Rav Yehuda ibn Hayuj, all of them subjects of previous lectures, as well as the great Talmudic giants of the post-Gaonic era, Rabbeinu Hananel, Rav Nissen Gaon, Rav Yitzchak Alfasi, known commonly as the Rif. Later in time, Rav Moshe ben Maimon, the Rambam, his son Rav Avram, graced the African continent, and still later, Rav Yitzchak ben Sheshes, the Rivosh, Rav Shimon ben Semach, the Tashbats, who originally came from Spain but took leading roles in North Africa. In a later lecture, we will study the medieval history of Egyptian Jewry. Tonight, we will cover the early history of North African Jewry and the communities west of Egypt, Libya, Tunisia, Algeria, and Morocco. Despite various legends, it is difficult with any certainty to know when Jews first lived in North Africa. We have records of a Jewish military garrison in Elephantine. It's an island in the southern Egypt across from Aswan that once contained a Jewish military garrison that wrote letters and shilas to the Jewish community in Jerusalem about Pesach and matzahs. The fascinating. And this was in the beginning of the period of the Second Temple, or before the building of the Second Temple. Their ultimate fate, though, is unknown. However, sometime afterwards, after the death of Alexander the Great, the general who finally took charge of Egypt was a person by the name of Ptolemy Soter, the Savior. And there's a story which we'll discuss in the next lecture that he came to Yerushalayim on Shabbos. And again, we only have one source, which is very difficult when you study history. One source is terrible because then you don't see what the other side says. You know, it's like the story that President Truman, when he was looking for a replacement in his amongst his economic advisors, he asked to find a one-handed economist, because every economist that he speaks to always tells him, but on the other hand. But the story that Josephus describes is that he came to Yerushalayim on Shabbos, attacked them, and took a tremendous number of Jews captives. It was not only Yerushalayim, he went north and took Samaritans captive. So that under the reign of his successor, his son, this is Ptolemy Philadelphus, again, according to Josephus' records, there were 120,000 Jews in Egypt and its environs. It went up to Cyrene. There's a community that's west of Egypt, on the east part of Libya, that was an old established community, Cyrenaica, again, which contained Jews from that period and on. That settlement, unlike the settlement in Elephantine, was continued on for hundreds and hundreds of years. Unfortunately, the conditions, though, were mixed. On one hand, especially in Alexandria, but in other places, wherever the Jews went, they were successful. But they encountered tremendous anti-Semitism. And some years ago, one of our lectures, we actually went through the anti-Semitic literature of the time, during the time of the destruction of the Second Temple. The first quote that we have, so this should be in your notes, is taken from Josephus, that describes the conditions between the Greeks, besides the indigenous population of North Africa, it was inhabited by Greeks. And of course, they were conquered by Greeks. And culturally, there was a Greek layer, on top of the indigenous Egyptian populace. They were the upper crust, so to speak, of Egyptians or Libyan society. And of course, there was a tremendous friction between them and the Jews. I don't know if I've said this in this lecture series. Some of those 24 years ago that we had a speaker come to the Kollel dinner. This is Mr. Irving Bunim. I hope you've heard of him. He's a tremendous speaker. And he was once asked, at least this is what he told us at the dinner, he was once asked to be the toastmaster at a dinner for the Fifth Avenue Synagogue. Fifth Avenue Synagogue is a very prestigious and wealthy Orthodox synagogue in New York City. And I don't know what the situation was that he was reluctant to speak, but the one who was trying to convince him told him, he says, you have to realize that this represents the upper crust of American Jewry. So Mr. Bunim addressed our audience and continued on. He just wanted to find, what is the definition of upper crust? So he looked in the dictionary. It said, under crust. It's a bunch of crumbs held together with lots of dough. The Greeks were the upper crust of Egyptian society. And there was a tremendous friction, as we said. In fact, during the time of Julius Caesar, which is in the middle of the first century before the Common Era, the Greeks wanted to take away the rights, the political rights from the Jews, which Caesar reinstated. But again, it's indicative of the state of affairs. Josephus describes at a later date the time of the destruction of mass pogroms. We've discussed this in detail in another lecture. In the year 116, and we just bring this about in terms again of the existence of Jews. Here we discuss in the first thing about Jews in Libya, right, which adjoins Cyrene. Here, in the year 116, there were mass pogroms against Jews. In these pogroms, eventually the entire populace of Alexandria in Egypt, which according to the Talmud numbered over a million, were completely destroyed. We have from the Church Chronicles, from Eusebius, who wrote an early church history. And he writes, this is referring to the year 116 of the Common Era, the Jews who are in Libya fight against other aliens dwelling there, likewise in Egypt and in Alexandria. In Cyrene, in Thebaid, which is in lower Egypt, they rush into great rebellion. But in Alexandria, the site of the pagan triumphs, and others there, they were successful in destroying all the Jews. But again, it just gives you an indication of where Jews lived, and that's where we're just bringing this. During the Talmudic era, we find quotes, it would seem, of Talmudic scholars who at least originated from Carthage. There's a question here, this is in paragraph B on the first page. Have you noticed in the brackets, it reads Carthage, but Carthagena. Carthage is where today is the country of Tunisia. It's in the middle of the northern African, the African continent on the north coast. In Spain, there was a city that was founded by the Phoenicians. It was an extension of Carthage called Carthagena. So one really cannot totally be sure, is it Carthage in Tunisia or Carthagena already in Spain? However, in any case, we find the Jews had spread out. It really makes more sense, as we're going to see, that probably refers to Carthage, which probably had a very large Jewish populace and already sent Bahram to Yeshiva and others, sent their children away. On page 2, top of page 2, we quote from the Gemara Menachos that describes against the essence of where do Jews live. And he says, this is from Tyre to Carthage, the nations know Israel and their father who is in heaven. In other words, they know the Jews, and the Jews have had a tremendous impact on the populace. There is a question from here on what the correct text is. What I write here is the original text, and I put a question mark. What it probably should read is from Tyre eastward and from Carthage westward, the nations know neither Israel nor their father who is in heaven. In other words, it is sparsely populated by Jews. But as we see from the next quote, that even though it was sparsely populated, but nonetheless there were Jews. As we find here on paragraph D on page 2, describing, this is the prediction. This is in Shiras Hazinu, in the song that we sing about the future of the Jewish people. Begoy novel al chisem, I will provoke them with a vile nation. There are various theories. What is the translation? Who is this goy novel, this vile nation? The Gemara quotes a brisa that suggests it refers to the people of Barbaria, the Barbary coast. Remember the pirates? This is Barbaria, which is Tunisia, and the people of Mauritania, which is Morocco, who go naked in the streets, which has been of a low level of culture. The Romans evidently had not penetrated to that area. For there was nothing more objectionable and abominable to the omnipresent, the man who goes naked in the streets. He has really no sense of shame. But they are called a vile nation. This is Goy Novel Achisim. Evidently, they made trouble for the Jews. So evidently, it would seem that there was somewhat, if we read the selection correctly, of a Jewish populace there. It wasn't a population center, but nonetheless, it seems from here that there were Jews that stretched out even this is to the ends of the north coast. As far as any actual record of Jewry, though, in this area, there exist tombstones with Hebrew inscriptions in the ancient Roman town of Volobolis, which is west of modern Fez. And there are Jewish tombstones with Latin writing in Algeria. From that itself, it would seem that there was a certain form of assimilation. But in any case, it does not seem they were centers of Jewry during these periods. It seems, though, that through time, the Jews did have a tremendous influence on that area, and that's the post-Talmudic era. The indigenous population of Morocco are Berbers. According to the great 14th century Spanish historian Ibn Khaldun, probably one of the greatest Arabic historians, the Jews made many converts amongst the Boter, one of the two major Berber tribal subdivisions during the pre-Muslim era, as the Muslims conquered North Africa in the middle of the 7th century. Before that, it seems that many of the Berbers converted to Judaism. Besides the converts, the Jewish population of North Africa increased with the influx of Jews fleeing Visigothic Spain at the end of the 6th and throughout the 7th centuries. As we discussed in the previous lecture, the Visigoths made life terribly difficult for Jews and really forced them, if they wanted to maintain their Jewishness, to flee. When the Arabs conquered the Maghreb, or West as they termed the whole northwest Africa, they found the country occupied by that time by numerous Jewish Berber tribes. That's just besides the Spanish Jews, they're actually, because these converts, actually a whole tribe of Jewish Berbers. The leader of one such tribe, who's Queen Dahiya al-Kahina, succeeded in blocking the Arab advance in the middle of the 8th century, in the 7th century, for several years. In other words, they were very powerful. After the fall of that area to Arab Muslims, the Jews were relegated to secondary status, the Dahimis. Because we have no record of how many Jews, these converts, became Muslims. We have very sparse records. That's the problem of having very few sources. But it would seem, according to these records, that many of the Jews of Morocco, especially those that lived in the south, far from the coast, which was occupied by Spanish Jews, the mountainous regions and desert oases, which are really inhabited by Berbers, are actually descendants from these original Jewish tribes. So just by itself, fascinating. And again, during this whole period, there was tremendous pressure for them to convert to Islam. Although the first wave of Arab conquerors tolerated the Jews, a new dynasty under King Idris in 788 forced the Jews to outwardly convert to Islam. This policy was changed with the ascent of his successor 3 years later. He rescinded the previous decrees, allowed the Jews to settle in his new capital, Fez, and ushered in a period of tolerance that would last some 350 years. Until the rise of power, the fanatical Muslim sect, the Almohads, which is a subject of a coming lecture. During the period of the Almohads, the Jews were forced to, those who remained, were forced to convert to Islam. Again, we have the problem of those who totally converted and those who were Maranos, and that which we'll see as we're going to go through this history, which became a pattern later, has a precedence for many hundred years before, as we discussed in the previous lecture. During the period of Visigoths, the Jews were Maranos, were secretly Jews. The lives of the great Jewish philosophers, scientists, and grammarians that North Africa produced, as we discussed, Rav Sadra, Rav Sadia Gaon, Rav Yitzchak Yisraeli, and many others were covered in previous lectures. Tonight, I would like to devote this lecture, at least the beginning of this lecture, to the great Talmudic giants that North Africa produced, and continue on to the great early Talmudists of Spain. As we said, this King Idris came to the throne in the year 788. By the beginning of the 9th century, North Africa had already become a major Torah center. And I would like to quote from Tekufas HaGaonim, period of the Gaonim, by Rav Simcha Asaf. He quotes, he says, "With regard to North Africa, it is evident that in the entire period of the Gaonim, we do not find a land or province where Jewry were in such constant contact with the Babylonian yeshivas as North Africa. Thousands of responsa were sent to this land. A particularly large percentage were sent to Kairouan. This went on for close to 300 years. Next in importance were the communities of Fez, Kabs, Tiemsin, Salgalmasa, Tiharet, and others. In the year 960, an event occurred that had a tremendous impact on all of North Africa and Spain. And that's the story that we've discussed in previous lectures of the Arba Shvuyin of the four captives. There were four Torah scholars who made their way from Bari in Italy that were captured by the navy of the Khalif. This is Abdul Rahman III. They were, these scholars who did not let on that they actually were scholars, were sold in the slave markets across North Africa and Spain. Reb Shmarios ben Elchanan, which we'll discuss in greater detail next lecture, was sold in Alexandria in Egypt. From there he went on to Fustat, which was the major center. Fustat, by the way, was the became the capital, or the Arab capital, this is under the Muslims. And he became the Rosh Hashiva. There was Reb Hushiel ben Reb Elchanan was sold in North Africa, says near Keruan. There he made his way to Keruan and opened the yeshiva there, and tremendous influence. And we know, says, that Rabbi Moshe and his son, says Rav Chanoch, were sold in Cordova, and again they made a tremendous impact there. We said Rav Shmuel Anoga, the subject of the last lecture, was a disciple of Rabbi Chanoch, who was one of those that was sold. As we explained in previous lectures, these four captives had studied in Italy. As perhaps as we're going to see, Rabbi Shmarya had studied also in Babylon by the Gaonim, but the others, it seems, were products of the great yeshivas in Italy. We have, again, we have records of the from the Cairo Geniza, one such letter that Rav Hushiel, who was sold in North Africa and Tunisia, sent to Rav Shmaryahu, his colleague, in Fustat, in Egypt. We also know, and you could look at this on page 2, we also know that Rav Hushiel did not have a strong connection to the yeshivas in Babylon. He had not studied there. His approach, it would seem, was different. His approach to Talmudic study was different. And in fact, there's a letter that we have on the top of page 3, the Rav Haigoin, addressed to the leaders of North African Jewry, of Keruan. And amongst the things that were said was that they had heard of this great Rav Hushiel ben Rav Elchanan, but they've never heard from him. They would like him to contact us. It seems during this period, though, which according to the one who brings this story, this is Rav Rami ben Daoud, the Ravid, it seems that North Africa underwent a change and ceased, under his influence, to have a close connection with the yeshivas in Babylon. At least the connection that had been there for so long was weakening. And this letter, which was written from Rav Hai going to the community, describes the fact that the community in North Africa already developed strong connections to the yeshivas in Israel. So it already had developed an independence. Again, do we just continue this section, Rav Hushiel, with descriptions, poems written about him by Rav Shmuel Hanogid. The end of the first poem, which is interesting besides the praises, it says, "To all who ask and seek understanding from distant places, you issue responsa." So it seems under Rav Hushiel, it wasn't just the Gaonim, the Babylonian yeshivas, that issued responsa, but Rav Hushiel itself, which is a sign of the independent nature that North Africa had taken on, independent of the yeshivas in Babylon. "You forsook your native land," which we explained is from Italy, "and came and set up yeshivas in Africa," which would indicate in the plural that it's even more than one. And again, this last, the last section is from the eulogy that Shmuel Hanogid gave to hearing the death of Rabbeinu Chushiel. Rabbeinu Chushiel had a strong impact on the next generation of scholars. And this is on page 4, and here we're going to quote from the Rav Avraham Ibn Daud in the Sefer Kabbalah. After the death of Rabbi Chushiel, his son and disciple Rabbeinu Chananel, of blessed memory, was appointed to head the yeshiva in Keruan, together with Rabbeinu Nisim ben Rabbi Yaakov ibn Shahon. This says Rabbi Yaakov, the father of Rabbeinu Nisim, was in constant contact with the Gaonim, he had been in constant contact with Rav Shmira Gaon. The famous letter that Rav Shmira Gaon, where he describes the history of the oral law and the history of the heads of the yeshiva through the period of the Gaonim, was addressed to this Rabbi Yaakov. They were both disciples of Rabbi Chushiel, and in addition, Rabbi Nisim received Torah guidance from Mrs. Rabbeinu Haigoin, who loved him very much and sent him whole works of response to all his questions immediately after he received them from Rabbeinu Nisim, which would indicate that Rabbeinu Chananel, being the son of his father, Rabbi Chushiel, had less of a connection to Rav Haigon of the Gaonim. We're going to see from further quotes, it doesn't mean he had no connection, but with Rabbeinu Nisim there was a very close connection, probably as a result of the connection that spanned generations from his father before him. Rabbeinu Shmuel Hanogid was able to drink of the waters of Rabbeinu Hai through the correspondence of Rabbeinu Nisim. In other words, through Rabbeinu Nisim became a link, says that Bovel, Iraq, became linked to Spain. Rav Shmuel Hanogid would generously help Rabbeinu Nisim, who was not a person of means. Afterwards, he became linked through marriage, as Rabbeinu Nisim sent his daughter to marry Rav Yehosef Hanogid, which we discussed in the last lecture. It seems that the Italian influence, though, was most greatly felt on Rabbeinu Chananel. And the next quote we have, this is one of several quotes, though, is the Rashbam, describing Rabbeinu Chananel, calls him Ish Romi, the man of Rome. Of course, he was born, it seems, in North Africa, but, you know, it's like a Galicianer. Like, it goes with you your whole life, you know, it goes generations. The Marshal, again, this is in his Rosh Shlomo Luria, who lived in the 16th century, in a very famous responsa, describes Rabbi Chananel also received Torah instruction from Rav Haigon, and probably again through the letters that came, you know, via, you know, Rabbeinu Nisim Gaon. Rabbi Yitzchak Alfasi, which we're going to discuss soon, and Rabbi Nosson, the author of the Oruch, who was a leader of Italian Jewry at the end of the 11th century, received instructions from Rabbeinu Chananel. In all probability, we know that Rav Yitzchak Alfasi was a student of his in the yeshiva. In terms of Rav Nosson, it was probably again through Rabbeinu Chananel's works. But he was a person who had a tremendous impact on the generation. In other words, here through Rabbeinu Chananel, we had both the streams of Babylonian Jewry, the scholarship that came from Babylon, the scholarship that came from Italy. And again, through that it was filtered, through other, back to Italy, and we'll see, so North Africa and on to Spain. What we have for Rabbeinu Chananel is his greatest legacy was a commentary that he wrote to three of the orders of the Talmud. As the Meiri quote in paragraph D says, it was extremely terse. He used the flawless text of the Talmud, but his wording was extremely terse. In other words, it was a very abbreviated commentary to the Talmud. And it would seem, as an abbreviated commentary, it was addressed to scholars. To non-scholars, generally more verbose. So his focus was to other scholars, it would seem. And it's interesting, as we said, that he was a conduit of these two traditions, the Italian and the Babylonian. We quote here on the bottom of page 4, Rabbeinu Hananel explaining, this is a tradition of the Gaonim. We've seen that our rabbis of the Gaonim, this is from Babylon of blessed memory, have an explanation of this topic different from the one I explained. However, this explanation, as his own, is based on tradition and transmission from our forefathers, meaning, of course, the Italian scholars. And you just thought of Italy just with pizza, probably. And again, he quotes on page 5. Again, this is another quote. Again, to his commentary, we've seen that the Gaonim have explained it in one way, but we have received the tradition in a different manner. He gave tremendous respect to the Gaonim, but on the other hand, he didn't dismiss his own traditions. And it's besides the traditions of understanding Talmudic texts, we do find sometimes we have extra Talmudic commentary. There's one interesting passage here. And there's a question, according to their calendar, if Tisha B'Av, which doesn't fall on according to our calendar, if Tisha B'Av would fall out on Friday, should we fast up until Shabbos, or should we eat something right before Shabbos to break our fast, so we shouldn't come into Shabbos while fasting? This is a discussion that the Talmud has. Rabbi Yehuda, the famous Rabbi Yehuda Bar Eloi, the famous disciple of Rabbi Akiva, testified that he was sitting in the presence of Rabbi Akiva. It was Tisha B'Av came out on Friday, and he ate a lightly roasted egg before nightfall. So he should not, as he fasted the bulk of the day, but right before Shabbos, he ate something. Rabbi Yossi disagreed and maintained that he did not accept the testimony of Rabbi Yehuda, and he maintained that, which was the halacha, it's only theoretical, that one fasts entire Friday. Rabbeinu Hananel, just below, lightly roasted egg, and this the Tosfos in Erevin quotes this, explained that we possess a tradition that Rabbi Akiva was actually critically ill that year. At the end of the day, the doctors brought Rabbi Akiva a lightly roasted egg to eat. Rabbi Yehuda was not familiar with the details of that story, and that's why he relied on what he saw without knowing the full details. This is not in the Talmud. This is a tradition that came for all generations. Again, we don't know. Again, it was in an Italian tradition. Was it a Babylonian tradition? There he doesn't tell us. But it's just fascinating about the Kabbalahs. In other words, these are extra Talmudic. They're not in the text, but it was carried like a Torah Sheval Peh, an oral tradition. There's another fascinating tradition here. But here he attributes this to the Gaonim, actually from Babylon. There is a description in the Talmud of a near-death experience where Rav Yosef, the son of Yeshua ben Levi, was comatose. And when he came to, he said that his soulless consciousness left his body and went to the other world. And he said he described what is El Yoinim Lamata V'Tachtonim Lamala. Those who are high, this is like this, you know, would we normally consider elevated here are below in the next world, and those who are below in this world are elevated in the next world. The commentators generally understand this in terms of social status. There's those who are impoverished or beleaguered, who are oppressed, and here it says have a higher, the oppressed have a higher status than the oppressors. However, Rabbeinu Hananel explained that the Gaonim have stated they have a tradition that was transmitted from rabbi to rabbi, that the upside world that he saw is referring to the fact that he saw Shmuel, this Mar Shmuel was the famous Talmudic authority in the beginning of the Talmudic era, who was sitting in front of Rabbi Yehuda, his disciple. In other words, in the next world, Shmuel was below and Rabbi Yehuda, his disciple, was above. And the reason is the Gemara in Shabbos and Nun Hei Amad Aleph in 55a describes an incident that there was a social problem of a woman who came and cried before Mar Shmuel, and she needed the intervention of the courts. Evidently, it was a very difficult situation. Shmuel did not want to get involved. He said, "There's higher authorities. Mar Ukva, who was the Av Bez, and he was the Reish Galusa. It's something for him to handle. It's not for me to deal with." Rabbi Yehuda says, "You know," and he gave him Musar. He says, "Oitim ozna mezakas dal. He who closes his ears to the cry of the poor, he shall also cry and shall not be heard." He gave him Musar. Says, "You can't just stand by." Because of this incident, that Shmuel was really held accountable because of this incident. In the next world, Rav Yehuda, this is that what he the vision that he saw was Rav Yehuda, the disciple, was on top, and Mar Shmuel was below. Again, this is extra Talmudic. In other words, this is not in the text at all. It was a tradition. So, just a fascinating the role, says, that Rabbeinu Hananu plays really is preserving, says, all these traditions. And again, this was a major source of the Sefer Oruch. This is Rav Nosson, the Rosh Hashiva of Rome in the end of the 11th century, whose work, the Oruch, is really, it's a classic today and is often quoted by the later authorities, especially Tosfos. Much of it relies on Rabbeinu Hananu. The Oruch is a dictionary. It's a fascinating thing. Because unlike other which are running commentators of the Talmud, or rephrasing of the Talmud, or a reordering of the laws of the Talmud, this is really a dictionary. But in the dictionary, he quotes all the places that this word is used, and in it comments on it. So it's a tremendous source of commentary as well. Rabbeinu Hananu was a major source of the Oruch. We just quote, just interestingly, which is something we're going to deal at length in another lecture. The Talmud very often deals in metaphor, the eyes of God, the ears of God, which, as the Rabbeinu Hananu points out, which is Scripture as well deals with this. In the battle that those who maintained the oral tradition had with the Karoyim, those who deny the oral tradition, the Karoyim would point out to the Talmud and say that how could you accept such an oral tradition? It's obviously absurd. And they would point to these in the Agadata, which really is only metaphoric in any case. There's the Agadata, and there's the Midrashic sections of the Talmud, would point to things which seem grossly to have anthropomorphisms. In other words, the God is spoken of as just as a superman. And here the Rabbeinu Hananu again addresses these issues and explains that it's just merely a metaphor, which is interesting, which today it's obvious. And as we're going to explain, that evidently in the time Rabbeinu Hananu wrote this, this was not so obvious, which is also amazing. As we said, basically Rabbeinu Hananu wrote for scholars. His colleague, though, Rabbeinu Nissen, who was called Rabbeinu Nissen Gaon, even though he wasn't a Gaon, this is the head of the yeshivas in Babylon, but because of respect, because of his exalted status, he was called Rabbeinu Nissen Gaon. It seems did write for the masses. The work is work which we only have extant, which is called the Mafteach. It's the key to the closed sections of the Talmud. It was originally written in Arabic. We have the Hebrew translation, which is printed in our version of the Talmud, in the first three tractates of the Talmud, Brocha, Shabbos, and Erevin. What it does is very often the Talmud assumes that the reader knows what it's talking about, but actually the full discussion is somewhere else. So what he did is filled it in, and then he says it's fully discussed here and brings the whole discussion. It's a tremendous work. It's very accessible. Evidently it was written in Arabic. It was written for non-scholars. It was interesting. The focus was very, very different. He also authored a work called Megillas Sesorim, which is often quoted by the Tosfos, by other Rishonim,
The Oruch quotes Rabbeinu Nissim extensively. This Megillah Storm, which is really his notes. I don't know if it was even meant to be published. In other words, probably after his lifetime. Again, basically, I believe written in Arabic, or much of it. It's halacha, agoda, there's biblical commentary, philosophy, there's responsa. Megillah Storm is a term which is used in the Talmud for hidden notes, and evidently it must be after his death it was published, as the fate of much which was originally written in Arabic, it is really has not survived, just we know from the quotes of others who quote this. He wrote also another popular work. When his grandson died, Rabbeinu Nissim wanted to console his daughter and his son-in-law, and wrote them a work that was called Chibur Yofa. See, it's Yofa HaYeshua. Says there was a beautiful work about salvation, and it was a collection of stories from the Talmud and the Medrash, which portray divine providence and the reward for those who are righteous. Now, this is a chizuk, is a strengthening. There's a song that many of us sing on Motzoi Shabbos called Ish Chosid Hoya. A story of a righteous person who was penniless, and Eliyahu Hanavi came to his aid, Elijah the prophet, and built this tremendous building, and he was paid handsomely for the work. Its sole source is really from this work, Chibur Yofa. Yeshua. There was a free Hebrew translation. Evidently, from that Hebrew translation, the author had created this song. It also seems that one of his daughters married, as we said, Rabbi Yehosef, the son of Shmuel Hanogid. We have from later sources that he accompanied his daughter to the wedding, the Rabbi the Chasana, and he had an impact on Spanish scholarship as well. The famous poet and philosopher, which we'll discuss in the next lecture, Shlomo Ibn Gabirol, it seems, heard shiurim from Rabbeinu Nissim Gaon. I'd like to quote now on page 7 from how the Ravid, as he's the main historian of this period, from Ibn Daud, describes the end of this period, the golden age of North African Jewry. Rabbeinu Hanan was very wealthy, in which contrasts with Rabbeinu Nissim Gaon, who was very poor. There were many merchants in Keruan who would offer him funding to go into joint business ventures. This would be a respectable way for a scholar to, you know, continue his learning. He had 9 daughters. He needed the money, evidently. But no sons. At his death, he left an estate of 10,000 gold coins. Similarly, Rabbeinu Nissim did not leave over a son. When they died, Talmud study on an advanced level ceased from the land of Africa. This is somewhat of an overstatement of a guzma, but as we're going to see. But a little was left in the city of Madia in the hands of the sons of Zugmar. We don't know who these are. And in the city of Kilach Hamad, which was, as we're going to see, is the native city of both Rabbi Yitzchak Alfasi and his Talmud Rabbeinu Ephraim, in the hands of Mar Shlomo Hadayan Ben Purmash. Renown did not spread across the world. I mean, besides this is the sole source, history does not know of these people. But it seems very often we find the anomaly of giants in a country but do not leave over, you know, students or children that will follow in their footsteps. And as the Ravid comments, the generation of these three, says Rav Hananel, says Rav Nissim Gaon, and Rav Shmuel HaNogid, were the first generations of rabbis after the Gaonim. From there, the power of Talmudic learning came back to Spain. And again, I just want to just summarize here on the bottom of page 7, we quote from the Meiri. It was a major was a major scholar in Provence in southern France in the end of the end of the 13th century. And he quotes and he describes the Rabbeinu Hananel, Rav Hai Gaon, and explains that in the yeshivas of the Gaonim, they learned the entire, all of the tractates, the entire Shas. And the next generation afterwards, though, they learned only four of the six orders. In other words, they did not study Zroim, which deals with agricultural laws, nor did they learn Tyrus, which are basically, these are more theoretical than practical. And the major focus was on the three practical Siddurim, those that deals with everyday lemoed, marital law, says Noshim, and civil law, says Nezikin. Plus, they studied Kodeshim. Kodeshim contains the Chulin, which contains the laws of Kashrus, and also the sacrificial laws, which the Talmud points out that has a, the study of those laws is the equivalent of having brought sacrifices. So for the merit of the study, that was stressed. But it seems that after the period of the Gaonim, and certainly from the time of Rabbeinu Hananel and on, there was a lessening in the quality of general scholarship. As I will just quote now, the end of this, there were now less scholars within the population. It was due to the immense compassion of Hashem that when a city would produce a single scholar that would have perfected himself, that scholar would generally feel himself duty-bound under these circumstances to help his nation to the best of his abilities. They didn't produce many, but those who did felt the importance, the need to have an impact. He would then go on to develop the prerequisite skills and knowledge to write important works.
Some of these were legal rulings and others were commentaries. So it would seem how the Meiri understands it, that already there was a lessening of the quality at this period of time, the period that we're going to now, from, this is with Rav Hai Gaon, Rabbeinu Hananel, and on. The Ravid goes on to explain that Rabbeinu Hananel, though Rav Nissen did leave a tremendous impact on their on the next generation through Rav Yitzchak Alfasi. He was a disciple of both Rabbeinu Hananel, was Rav Yitzchak of Fez, and Rabbeinu Nissen. It seems he came originally from the town of Kilah Hamad in Algeria, but eventually moved on to Fez. He was there till he was approximately 75 years old. We only know of one disciple of any note. This is Rabbeinu Ephraim of Kilah Hamad. But when he was over 75, he had a new lease on life. And sometimes, as the worst sorrow, as it would seem, that the worst tragedy came out for himself and for the world to be an act of the greatest import and the greatest benefit. He was in 1088, when he was 75 years old, he was forced to flee, to leave his homeland, and to go to Spain because of someone who had informed on him, because of Masira, someone who had informed on him to the government. He first came to Cordova, but went on to the city of Lucina, which formerly had been the seat, which is of another great Talmudic scholar, Yitzchak Gias, we're going to explain soon. And he was there for 15 years. As he died at the year of, approximately was 90 years old. There he established many disciples, there in Spain at 75, there's still hope, and his renown spread throughout the world. He composed Sefer Halachas, which is an abridged version of the Talmud, and from the time of Rav Hai there has been no one to equal him in wisdom. This is how the Rav, Avram ibn Dawud, explains what kind of a person he was. The thrust of that work, which is a condensed version of the Talmud,
relies mainly on the Babylonian Talmud. And as he himself explains, and this is echoing the words of Haigon, the Babylonian Talmud is the more authoritative of the two. There's the Yerushalmi of the Palestinian, from Eretz Yisrael, says, and that was written earlier in a less complete form. It seems that those of the Talmud who wrote the Talmud Bavli were aware of the opinions, and if they disagreed, they had already discounted them, because they represented a later period which contained all the scholars together, wrote the Talmud Bavli, at least in its final form, both Israeli scholars because of Christian persecution were forced to flee, and native Babylonian scholars. The Babylonian Talmud is the more authoritative. This already in the words were of Haigon, but he became sealed through the Rabbi Yitzchak Fassi. It's interesting how others, later generations, write of him. The Ri HaZoken, who was the grandson of great-grandson of Rashi, who was leading in his time, the leader of the authors of the Tosfos, says it would have been beyond human strength to create a work of that stature had not the Shekhinah, the divine presence, been resting upon the Rabbi Yitzchak Fassi when he wrote that work. Even one of his greatest critics, Rav Zrachya Halevi, who was in Provence in the 12th century, writes of him, since the completion of the Talmud, such a beautiful work has not been created. And again, the Ravid, this is Avram, this is Ben David, who is the famous critic of the Rambam, which we'll discuss in the further lecture, speaks about the Rif, even though he criticizes him. He says, I'm ready to rely upon Rabbi Yitzchak Fassi, even he tells me which I deem to be the right is actually the left. In other words, I will follow him no matter what. Even though he was a person who had tremendous authority, this is much after his lifetime. The Rambam, even though in his works he disagrees with him on numerous occasions, writes that there are only ten places within the Rabbi Yitzchak Fassi's work which are subject to criticism. Scholars understand this to be criticism in the sense it's impossible. Where there are others that are, which really are a call. In other words, that it could be interpreted like this or like that. The disagreement is a matter of taste rather than true scholarship. So those who followed him, says the generations after him, the Rif is really one of the pillars of sources of halacha. When the Shulchan Aruch wrote his work, actually he said that he based his work on three pillars of halacha. The first being Rabbi Yitzchak Fassi. The other two is the Rambam and the Rosh. The Rabbeinu Usher, again, which we'll discuss in further lectures. On page 10, you can take a look yourself of the inscription on the gravestone of Rabbi Yitzchak Fassi. This is printed in the Talmud. It's called the Sefer Tumim. This is a Tumim Derech, and it goes through his whole life. But in the greatest of terms. Besides the work itself, it spawned other tremendous works, because of course there were those who criticized him. Since his Talmud, his disciple in North Africa, Rabbeinu Ephraim of Kilach Hamad, which we don't have extant, his criticisms, only again how it's quoted in the works of others, the Ravid, as we quoted before, of Roms ben David, the Baal Hamor, the Zerachya Halevi, wrote running critiques of the Rif, and the Ramban, Rav Moshe ben Nachman, again a subject of a coming lecture, wrote a very fervent defense. This all became part of the literature. There were numerous commentaries written, and they're published in standard editions of the Talmud. The standard edition of the Talmud, like this red, this one over here, which is the Vilna edition, the expanded Vilna edition, in the back has the Rif. It's standard. And there are the many commentators. There's the Ran, Rabbeinu Nissim ben Ruvain, the 14th century Spain. There's Rabbi Yonason and Erevin ben David HaKoyen of Lunil of Provence, of 12th century Provence. There's the Nemuka Yosef of Yosef Chaviva, again 14th century, 15th century Spain. These are when one studies the Talmud in depth, Bi'iyun, it is really part of the program. You learn through the Gemara, Rashi, Tosfos. You learn, then you look at the Rif and various commentaries on the Rif, Rabbeinu Yitzchak Alfasi. Other works, again, how this spawned other works, is that there were later scholars who felt that the Rif had left out things. Because, unlike other previous works, it was really based solely on the Talmud, and there was not that much that was quoted from the response of the Gaonim. What was quoted from the Gaon was really interpretation of the Talmud, but other responses dealing with related issues were not quoted. And again, this spawned a whole work. There's a Sefer Ha'itim, Rabbi Yehuda ben Barzilai, which is no longer extant, which was an expanded version containing all of the response of the Gaonim. In its time, it was really a reservoir of knowing the Gaonic literature. Very little has survived. The Sefer Eshkol, this is the father-in-law of the Rav Rom ben David, actually, it would seem to have created this condensed version of the Sefer Ho'itim, and from this we know many of the response of the Gaonim. So again, it's not only in itself, but it spawned. He had the merit of all this Torah came through him. It's a tremendous chus. Up until now, we have discussed the North Africa, Rabbeinu Hushiel, Rabbeinu Hananel, Rabbi Nissen Goyen, the Rif. I'd like to now just briefly discuss who were the contemporaries of Yisrael Fasi who actually lived in Spain. Because as we said, Spain itself had its own tradition of scholarship. We mentioned this is the of the four captives, Rabbi Moshe, Rabbi Hanoch, who was the teacher of Shmuel Hanogid. During this period, we're on page 11 here, there was a Yitzhak Bar Yehuda Ibn Gias. And Gias is the Arabic, it means Moshiach. And he used to sign his name in the Shuvas, Tilas Hashem al Yeshua, Shosel Iro, thanking Hashem for the salvation made for his city. It says, Chosam Shmo Yitzhak Ben Yehuda Beno Moshiach. In other words, Ben, the family of the Savior. Maybe he was a descendant from Malchus Ben Shaddai. It's not clear. But Ibn Gias means Moshiach, means Savior. He lived in the city of Lucina, it seems, prior to Rabbi Yitzchak Alfasi. He died in the same year that Rabbi Yitzchak Alfasi came to Spain. He was a Shmuel Hanogid, and his son Rabbi Yehoshua gave him tremendous honor and esteem. And in fact, when, as we last time, Rabbi Yosef Hanogid, his whole family was killed out in the year 1067, his son Azariah fled to Rabbi Yitzchak Ibn Gias. That was the home that he came to. So they were very close, like family. Rabbi Yitzchak wanted him. He's the successor from Shmuel Hanogid. He wanted to build him up. He would make him the rov, the leader of all of Jewry. But unfortunately, he died. He died very young. This son, and it didn't. He died soon after this incident. He was a tremendous poet. So you can read the thing. He was a tremendous secular scholar. He had many disciples, and he continued on in the tradition that we've seen with Shmuel Hanogid, and before him we find from Rav Sadia Gaon, that contained both. They were great geniuses, both in Talmudic and in, 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 in Torah learning, but also in general knowledge as well. This kind of combination we don't find, for instance, in Rabbeinu Hananel. We just don't find it. Or Rabbeinu Nissim Gaon, at least not to be known for that. Maybe they did have, but Keruan, at that point, in all probability, was not a major center of secular study, as Cordova was, where Shmuel HaNogad lived. Rabbeinu Yitzhak Alfasi, we do have, besides what he wrote, the halachas, we have responsa from him, but we do not have any intimation that he was really was acquainted with other forms of knowledge. Rabbi Yitzhak Ibn Gias, though, seems to be a continuation of the tradition of Spanish Jewry that had both. He not only, of course, was a tremendous scholar, it seems he was the leading scholar, the leading rav of all of Spain during his time. Everybody's source, everyone's problems came to him. He was busy teaching, and despite the fact that he wanted to write, it seems he completed very little. There was a work written by him called Me'ah Shorim. This is a, 100-fold or 100 gates, which he began, which is often quoted, as you see on page 11. The Kolbo brings down about the regarding says about the saying of Yom of Kol Nidre, which was this. Source of major discussion on page 12, we have in the halachas of Lulav. But of course, the work as a whole did not survive. He wrote on Chumash. He was a versatile scholar. Ibn Ezra quotes him, as we see on page in paragraph C. He was a religious poet, as we'll see. Beautiful poetry that he wrote. It was outstanding. Even the Moshe Ibn Ezra, one of the great poets of Spain, who was a disciple of his, writes, the poems of Ibn Gias are engraved on the forehead of the precious, and it plays onto the ramparts of metaphor. There's a Shira Ibn Gias al Metzach HaYakor Huchak Bol Mivtzarei HaMelitza Yishok. This is one of his disciples was Rav Yosef Ibn Sahal, who later became a dayan, head of the dayan, a judge in the Bezdin in Cordova. It seems though, it would seem from the various pages we had before on page 11, the positions were given, it seems, to scholars that already were late in life. Ibn Gias died in the year 1089. His disciple only became Rav Yosef Adayan only became a dayan towards the end of his life in the year 1113. That's 25 years later, and then he was only there for 11 years as a dayan. It seems in the end of his life. But besides his greatness of thing, he was evidently a tremendous genius, and he wrote this beautiful poem that I just on page 13. Just to read, it's beautiful. Not only it's normally we think of poetry. We had various. Rabbi Yitzhak Ibn Gias wrote religious poetry. In fact, the poetry that he wrote, really much of it survived. There's 118 piyutim that he wrote, and in the there's a machzor of Tripoli, which is that of North African Jewry that much of those piyutim that he wrote survived. They were basically religious poems, beautiful poems. But we know of secular poetry that was written at the time as well. In the last lecture, we quoted from a Shmuel HaNogad about wine songs and war songs. This is about flies. It is beautiful. Not only the rhyming, but the sense of the zzz of the fleas, as this is a parashim kafarashim yirutzun The fleas charge like war horses. The Ch'of Lechol says, Ori Yutsun, and they swoop down like birds to devour my skin. The Kisirim Yerakedun Svivi, so they keep around me like he goats. The Osi Mitnuosi Kitsun, and they rouse me out of my sleep. The Nilesi Haroi Katon Vagadol, I'm weary of killing both the small ones and big ones. La Hachniyam Vehem Lo Yaritsun. I do it to rout them, but they know no fear. Says Kigiborim v'molchamtom k'sheilev. Says Asher b'nefol acheim yamitzun. They're stout-hearted like warriors in battle who pluck up their courage when their comrades fall. V'miyu ma'at b'yom atzelim. If they're a little lazy during the day, b'vol says Lyle says kiganov yecharutzun. So when night comes, they're as nimble as thieves. The heinaf shibachol yom kotzrovom. Day after day, I loathe them. The yodem meharag osam yukutsun, and my hands are sick of killing them. The hofach says minishi chosam besori, and their bites have covered my flesh with sores. Says chabar burois kemoi rimon yinsun, says they blossom like pomegranates. Elokim hachrimem kivelinum says ani dova vehema yalaitsun, says. Hashem wipe them out from an anguish and cannot sleep while they exult. The genius is, and he was a Dayan in Cordova. So you see, in a certain sense, a different stream, than we would expect, let's say, from the Rif, it's Al-Fasi. Another one of the scholars during this period of time was Rav Yitzchak ben Boruch ben Yaakov ben Boruch ibn Albalia. This is on page 14. He was from the community of Cordova. His forefathers came from the city of Merida. Merida at one time was a great city, as he's going to explain. I mean, later on, during the period that we're discussing, it would have been destroyed. It was non-existent. When Titus conquered Jerusalem, his general, who was appointed over Spain, an amazing story, asked him to send to Spain from the nobility of Yerushalayim. He sent some of them. Amongst them was a man who made curtains in the Beis HaMikdash in the temple, who was an expert in silk handiwork. His name was Boruch, and that's where that word, the name Boruch, kept on continuing on in the family, generation after generation. So he was this Reb Yitzchak ben Boruch that we're going to discuss was a contemporary of Reb Yitzchak ibn Gias. He stayed in Merida, where he fathered children, this Boruch. At one time, Merida was a large community. You can read yourself that Rav Sadia Gaon speaks of the great city of Merida. Because of the wars, Merida was destroyed. Reb Yitzchak ibn Alabia's forefathers went into exile and settled in Cordova. There they became some of the most prominent leaders. Reb Yitzchak was born in the year 1035. He was also a seeker of wisdom and a lover of Torah. It would seem when they speak about seeker of wisdom, they speak about general knowledge. He was a great scholar, came to Cordova from France by the name of Rebbe. This is Prigoras. Evidently, this is the only source we know of him. Reb Yitzchak did a great favor for him, supplied him with his needs, and in turn, this scholar says became his Rebbe. And Reb Yitzchak says learned from this Rebbe Prigor. This is a Prigor. Reb Shmuel Hanoged had a close relationship to this Reb Yitzchak ben Boruch. Even though when he was only, while he was a child, he sent him svarim, books, and gifts. And he saw, says, that this budding genius needed to be cultivated. When Shmuel Hanoged died in the year 1055, this Reb Yitzchak was 20 at the time, Reb Yitzchak sent a pamphlet on the Soda Ibur, which is a very difficult work, the calculations of the calendar, to Reb Yehosef Hanoged, Reb Shmuel's son. Reb Yehosef sent him money to show his esteem to support his continued studies. Reb Yitzchak then started coming to Granada, where Reb Yitzchak Hanoged was. He used to come back and from his home in Cordova always to visit. It was a place open to scholars, Granada, or Yosef Halevi held court. He happened to be in Granada in that day in 1067 when the entire Jewish populace was destroyed. He was miraculously saved. He started acquiring many Sforim, evidently the Sforim the library of the Arabs took, and then sold them on the market, and he began to acquire them on the open market of the Nogid Sforim, and were scattered across the world. He composed a great work called Kupas HaRochlam, which is on Halacha, which has not survived. But he didn't complete. He was not able to complete it before he died. This the Ravid was a descendant of his. He died in Granada in the year 1094. So he was a young man. He was not even 60. And he was the grandfather of the Ravid. He was the father of the Ravid's mother. But he was a person, it seems, that I wanted to put this in context for the next part of this, who not only had Torah knowledge, but secular knowledge as well. So we have this stream from Shmuel HaNogid and those who came in contact with him, Rabbi Yitzchak Ibn Gias, Rabbi Yitzchak Ben Boruch, who were not only Torah scholars, but were general scholars as well. Which takes us now to his Rabbi Yitzchak's Ben Boruch's son, who he named Boruch. Again, this name went on from that first Boruch, went on for generations. This Rabbeinu Boruch was born in the year 1077. His father was relatively, he says his father had died when he was still a teenager. He was only some 17 years old when his father died. Before his death, Rav Yitzchak told his son Boruch, "I want you to go to study under Rav Yitzchak Alfasi. I want you to go to Lucina and study under the Rif." And he gives us some background which creates more questions than answers, but it seems that there was an argument between him and Rav Yitzchak Alfasi, between this Rav Yitzchak Albalia and Rav Yitzchak Alfasi. And similarly, there was a great argument between Rav Yitzchak, says Ben Yehuda Ibn Gias, and Rav Yitzchak Alfasi. He doesn't say what that argument was. However, and we'll touch upon this soon, when he passed away, Rav Boruch, as we point out, was only 17 years old. He was about to die. He called his son and whispered in his ear, and he told him, "Go to Rav Yitzchak Alfasi." Here, at least, in terms of the Ravid's writing history, this is his grandfather's death, and this happened to his uncle. This Rav Boruch also was the Ravid's Rebbe, who was also his teacher. "Go to Rav Yitzchak Alfasi and tell him that I'm leaving this world and entering the next. I've already forgiven him for all the harsh things he said to me, whether in writing or verbally. Similarly, I ask of him that he also do so and teach you. Stand before him. I know that he will do for you a great favor and teach you Torah with all his heart." Rav Boruch continued on to tell me, and this is the Ravid is writing this, Rav Ibn Dawud, says, "After I buried my father, my master, I went to Lucina and told him all that my father had commanded me. When Yitzchak ben Alfasi cried without stop, he came back to himself and began to console me, to speak words that made a deep impression upon my heart. He told me, 'If your father, blessed memory, died, don't worry, for I will be for you a father and you for me a son.' I stood in his house," this Boruch, the son says, "until I had studied in his presence the entire Talmud." That takes a while. When Rav Yitzchak ben Alfasi died, the renown of the pair was Rav Yosef Halevi, which we're going to discuss soon, and Rav Boruch, Rav Yitzchak, spread throughout the land. Rav Boruch knew Greek wisdom in addition to his Torah knowledge and general wisdom. He established many disciples. I am the smallest of them all. He passed away at the end of Elul in the year 1126. He was a young man. Rav Yosef outlived him 15 years. During that period, he had no one of his caliber in his generation. So since his generation is a third generation, and as Rav Yosef who lived, as those two, Rav Yosef HaLevi and Yitzchak, were actually in a class by themselves. And after Baruch died, Rav Yosef HaLevi there's no one of his caliber, and his is the third generation of Rabbonus. Here I just quote in the bottom, here is a poem which was written in the honor of Rabbi Baruch by Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi. But again, we find again this theme of Greek wisdom. We don't know what they argued about. But one perhaps just could venture a hypothesis that we do know in a later generation, this is going to be a theme we're going to touch upon again, that those that were steeped with both Talmudic wisdom and Greek wisdom had a different approach, at least to the Agadotas, to the Midrashim, to some of the theology of Judaism, than those who took a strictly Talmudic approach. We know that in the great arguments that ensued after the Rambam wrote his works. One wonders if Rabbi Yitzchak Alfasi, that we do not know of any general knowledge or his any connection to Greek wisdom, in all probability, his approach to the Talmud, or at least to the Agadic sections, was much different than someone like Rabbi Yitzchak Ibn Giyas, who would tend to look at statements that deal with the supernatural in a different light. Those who are more in touch with Greek study would look at more metaphorical, or not to be relied upon, because they really counter with the sensibilities of the rationalists. Those who come from a different school accept it as literally. And this question of those who accepted the literalists and the non-literalists, which became a great source of disputation later on, perhaps was even felt during this period. And again, this is just merely a theory, but it would account, though, we would say, about the harsh words, and which we do find in a later generation did much come out amongst people of the highest caliber. So I don't know, but it's a hypothesis. I'd just like to end this lecture here with Rav Yosef Ibn Migash, where it says, was the end of what we call the golden era of Spain. As we started here from the captives, and as we said, Chizloi Ibn Shaprut, and the four captives, and Moshe Ben Hanoch, who goes on to Shmuel HaNogid, Rabbi Yitzchak Ibn Giyas, Rabbi Yitzchak Ben Boruch Al-Balya, Rabbi Boruch Ben Balya, this whole connection, later on it's infused with Rabbi Yitzchak Al-Fasi. The end of that era came with Rabbi Yosef Ibn Migash. Rabbi Yosef Ibn Migash's famous Talmud, the Talmud, as we're going to touch upon, the most famous, even though the others perhaps of greater stature, but the most famous of his disciples was the father of the Rambam, Beinu Maimon. So through Rabbi Yosef Ibn Migash, we get to the Rambam. He describes him, this is the again, our major sources is the Ravid Avram Ibn Daud. The Rabbeinu was born in the year 1077, again, just like, as we said, Reb Boruch Ben Yitzchak before. Reb Meir, his father, was a Talmud Chacham, was well-respected. Reb Yosef, Meir's father, was the one who fled from the city of Granada. This is when King Badis, as we had mentioned, this is last week's lecture with Balkan and Badis, and there were the two brothers, and when the political winds changed, Rav Yosef Ibn Migash's grandfather, Yosef Ibn Migash, fled to Seville. Seville was the arch enemy of Granada. When Rav Shmuel HaNogid led the army, he led the armies of Granada against the armies of Seville. Baruch Hashem, Jews probably didn't serve in the army, but he was the general, Shmuel HaNogid of Granada. But in Seville, this Yosef Ibn Migash, the grandfather of, served the king, Abu Abad, From the time Rav Yosef was a child, Rav Yitzchok Baruch, which we discussed, the Albalia, recognized he grew up to be a giant in wisdom. He was a true prodigy. Rav Yitzchok prevailed upon Rav Meir to provide teachers for Rav Yosef day and night. He took such an interest in the child because both Rav Yitzchok Baruch and Meir Levi were fast friends. And when Rav Yitzchok Ibn Alfasi immigrated to Spain and settled in Lucina, Rav Yosef Alevi traveled from that to the city of Seville to study under him. He was then only a child of 12 years old. He stood for Rav Yitzchok for 14 years and studied in his presence day and night. In essence, he became Rav Yitzchok's son, full of understanding, which Rav Yitzchok nurtured with full wisdom. Before he died, Rav Yitzchok appointed him to fill his position. He was the appointed successor. And at that thing, he says he came to him when he was 12 years old. He studied for 14 years. He was only 26 years old, and he became the greatest Rosh Hashiva in all of Spain. He was a tremendous prodigy and a genius. Before he died, he says before he wrote an approbation, you know, like a Ksav Rabonis, he wrote. And he says that the person, the stature of Yosef, did not exist even in the generation of Moses. He was tremendously impressed by him. Because Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses wanted, when he's finding members of the Sanhedrin, he wanted wise men and understanding, full of knowledge. Men of understanding he could not find. Rav Yosef was a man of understanding. Tremendous respect for him. And he continued on after the death of Yisrael Fassi to be Rosh Hashiva for a period of 38 years. During that whole period, the study of Torah was his sole occupation. In other words, he had followed Yisrael Fassi, and he was not involved in anything else. Because he was not an astronomer, he was not an astrologer, he wasn't a mathematician or a poet. He was a Talmud Chacham. That was his sole occupation. His renown spread from Spain to Egypt and Babylon to all the lands. In addition to his great wisdom, he possessed refined character traits that bore testimony to the descendant of Moshe Rabbeinu. He was a Levi. He was the most humble of all men, and as a man of such genius, he was the greatest onav, most humble. The Holy One, blessed be, granted him an open heart, and he would forgo taking revenge. Evidently, he was involved in communal life. There's problems, and would forgive those that hurt him. And evidently, the Ravid knew him. May the Holy One bless him, reward him for all that he had done for the Jewish people. The Rambam writes of him. That's because, again, Rambam's father was a disciple of his. For those who have seriously studied his works and the depth of his intelligence, it is evident that the intellectual capacity of that man was so astounding, be said of him, that there was no king equal to him who preceded him. He was like, this is one of the miracles in the survival of the Jewish people, that there are these stars that Hashem has brought down from heaven and given to us. He wrote a comprehensive commentary on Talmud. Little has survived. We do have from some of his mesechtas, others quote him, but it seems that the influence that he had lived beyond his lifetime, as we're going to see through the life of the Rambam. This concludes this lecture. Mirz Hashem, we will continue on. The next lecture, we will deal not with Talmudic scholars, but with poets. And we're going to slowly inch our way through the poets back to the Rambam.
Bring down the generation, or was that something like a light-hearted lark that went on?
Yeah, There's a question about how do we understand this and the thing. He was a Dayan in Cordova. He was a great disciple. This is Ibn Sahal. So, how do we understand this as writing poetry about flies? You know, I think even great men need to relax. But the question is, we find, this is a subject we had some years ago, says about Acher, says Elisha ben Avuya, who became an apostate, and the Talmud attributes it from his readings, Greek wisdom. So how do we understand that? It would seem to be the danger of studying this. I mean, he went off, and the widespread study of Greek wisdom during this period of our... I think that the answer is twofold. I believe, first of all, that this is a theme that we discussed in the lecture about Acher. Acher, it seems that the writings that he read were religious writings. In other words, actually, this is the theory that I purported then, that Acher became an early Christian. And the writings that he came were really from one of the sources, were not really Sifra Yevonim, that's what's written in our text, the Greeks, but Sifra Avalgilion, says the evangelical writings. He basically studied comparative religion. So that's one, there's a difference. But I think a second, which is extremely important to understand it in this context, where he lived in the second century Palestine, Elisha ben Avuya, there was no need to study Greek wisdom. It wasn't an issue. The Jews weren't being challenged. It wasn't expected that how could you be a man of Talmud and know so little about the world? Because the focus of Talmudic scholars was just that, Talmudic scholarship, or Torah scholarship, in the broad sense of the biblical scholarship. There was no need for a Talmudic scholar in that era to really know that knowledge. What he was doing, it really was a lark. He was just interested. And in that sense, because there was no pressing need, his interest would indicate a dissatisfaction that existed within his own heart that would cause him to search in other places for meaning. In the era that we're speaking about, in non-Jewish society, there was a whole layer of Islamic scholars who were well read in Aristotle and all the Greek philosophers and all the various works. It was became part of general education. One didn't go off to study this. It's just that one today does not go off when he studies geometry. That's part of your curriculum. And this is part of what's understood to be expected of one who lives within a society. So here, they did not look at it. It was really with the same, that they're going off. This is what everybody knows. And everyone should know, because if anyone has questions, they need someone to answer those questions. I mean, this is what we find with the Rambam and many others. If you have no one to answer questions, people with questions just go off. So in a certain sense, they may have felt that it was important for them to take away time from their Torah studies for this knowledge, they felt in their position as a people of influence.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237. Or call 1-800-797-7729.